The scientific community largely agrees climate change is here. Yet the public debate over climate change is so hot, so heavy, and tremendously polarizing. Andrew Hoffman wanted to explore just what causes people to accept or reject the scientific consensus on climate change. And the result is his new book, How Culture Shapes the Climate Change Debate. And he's the director of the Erb Institute for Global Sustainable Enterprise at the University of Michigan, where he's also a professor of sustainable enterprise. Always good to see you, Andy.
It's good to see you too, Cynthia.
Well, you start the book out by being pretty critical of the traditional academic approach to talking about climate change. Why is that?
It's not just the academic approach to climate change. It's the academic approach to research. We are encouraged. We are given incentives. We get tenure for writing articles, which is very important. I'm not knocking that. But there is no incentive to take all those articles and pull them together and tell the story as a whole. I use the analogy from an article I found in Science magazine in 1963, where he worried that the field of academic science was going to become a field of brickmakers. We all make little bricks, but no one's building the wall. In this book, I'm trying to bring together all the social science I could find on why people reject the science of climate change, because I think that whole story needs to be told.
From your view, however did this climate change issue become so toxic, so polarized?
Well, it has become a debate over values. It's really not about science anymore. It's not about CO2 and climate models. When people talk about climate change today, it's become so muddied and so connected with concerns over bigger government. Distrust of environmentalists, distrust of democratic politicians. For some people, distrust of science. For some people, climate change even challenges their notion of God. God's in charge out there. We're not that big that we can actually change the global climate. And so these are the elements of the debate that have become conflated with climate change. And there's a whole literature in the social sciences to explain why this happens.
As you point out in your book, How Culture Shapes the Climate Change Debate, more scientific information isn't the answer.
Especially when people connect it to their personal identity. There are numerous variables you can look at to try and sort of determine someone or connect with someone's belief on climate change. Gender, age, income level, education level. These are all the standard demographic variables. But the strongest correlate is political party affiliation. The majority of Republicans do not believe climate change is happening. The majority of Democrats do. There's the smoking gun that this is a cultural debate. Mm-hmm. It's a debate over worldviews. It's not about science at all. And I want to caveat that the public debate.
The public debate.
The public debate is about values. The scientific debate has reached a consensus. That is the word that's used by the American Association for the Advancement of Science and the National Academies of Sciences to say that there is a consensus around the idea that climate change is happening.
So here we have scientific consensus, and it is butting heads with public debate.
Yeah, which is natural.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people feel, well, scientists just produce their results and then people should just accept them and move on. And I kind of look at this book that, you know, scientists produce their results and say this is happening. For the most part, economists are saying, and the answer is a price on carbon. The fields of sociology, psychology, anthropology, they can say, but why do people accept or reject both those conclusions? And they're an important part of the conversation because most people are scratching their head saying, how can this happen? And it really is when we're faced with complex scientific issues or any issue that we don't quite understand, our emotions kick in first and our reason kicks in second, a distant second. And so very often we'll have a quick emotional reaction and we spend the rest of the time acting more like a lawyer, trying to find ways to support that emotional response. If I hear something from a particular messenger, and I can offer two right now, Fox News or NPR. One of those will create a response in the audience that I'll believe what they say or I don't believe what the other says.
Yes.
Or I could say Rush Limbaugh and Al Gore.
Yeah.
Again, who says it is as important as what's being said. We need to understand the social dynamics of what we call motivated reasoning, that I will look at information and I'll try and find ways to use that to confirm my worldview and I will resist ideas that challenge that worldview.
I'm talking with Andy Hoffman. His book is How Culture Shapes the Climate Change Debate. He, of course, is director of the Erb Institute for Global Sustainable Enterprise at the University of Michigan. And in your book, you break down four ways that you categorize this distrust. Distrust of the messengers, of the process that created the message, distrust of the message itself, and distrust of the solutions. With all that distrust swirling around, Where do we go with all of that?
Well, once you understand where someone's coming from, and it is about trust. You know, science, when it comes out with a conclusion that asks people to change their beliefs and their behavior, they need to trust. You know, I can say I come from an environment where I do trust science. Mm-hmm. I trust that there's something called an atom. It has electrons flying around a nucleus, and this body is made up of billions of these. I'll never see them. I can never prove they exist, yet I trust science because it tells me it's so. But we can't expect everybody to just trust that or trust the conclusions. And so if you can understand the forms of distrust, then you can start to engage the debate to try and deal with those. So distrust of the messengers. We need more messengers that will resonate with people that resist the science. And I pinpoint two of them. We need more messengers from the business community, and we need more messages from the ideological right. They will reach people that people on the ideological left or NGOs cannot reach. People will trust something if it comes from someone that they trust.
And are we seeing, we've talked about this on Stateside, where we are seeing business realize it's to their benefit and it's to the bottom line benefit to deal with climate change and prepare strategies?
I would say some businesses.
Some.
And that's the key.
Yeah.
Climate change for the business community represents a market shift. And in any market shift, you're going to have winners and losers. The losers will resist the change. The winners will try and promote it.
And distrust of the solutions. Again, that's a tough one to get past.
Well, yeah, and just think about it. I mean, what do we do? Well, perhaps we have a carbon price. Mm-hmm. And then people start to hear more government intrusion in the market, and that's a very resonant debate today. Or you could even take it if you want to really hit the real hot button issue, and we perhaps need to do that globally. Who should do that? Well, maybe the UN, and now you've really hit a hot button. A lot of people are very distrustful of the idea of national sovereignty being intruded on by some kind of global carbon price. How do we frame solutions in a way that represents a future that we all desire, one that addresses both our interests as a collective but also individual rights and individual freedoms that can't be infringed upon? How do we find solutions that walk that line? There's the challenge, and it's a thorny one.
It is a thorny one, and you have this image of our children or our great-grandchildren living with the effects of what science agrees is coming and looking at this point in history, and the idea of Nero fiddling while Rome burns mm-hmm. kind of comes to mind.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the answer is not simply to allow this to devolve into what I call a cultural schism. I don't think it has. Mm. I think it's getting toxic, but I don't think it has. There is movement. There is some change. I think the Pope coming out and giving an encyclical on environmental issues, whether he mentions or says right out that climate change is happening, I think that is encouraging that a religious leader would come out and say that there's a moral component to this debate. My hope is that his statement may allow some cover for some conservatives who are Catholic or not to say, you know, climate change is real. Look, the Pope did it. And it's not anathema or it's not contradictory to say I'm a conservative Republican and I think climate change is real.
Meantime, in your book, you tell us 2/3 of Americans rarely, if ever, discuss climate change or global warming with family and friends.
Yes.
What does that tell you?
I'm sure we've all been there, that the topic comes up and the conversation starts to ice over. Or you start to feel this anxiousness start to emerge. And that, to me, it recognizes the emotionality of the mm-hmm. issue. So tread lightly, tread carefully. If you are sitting down with someone who says, I don't believe climate change is happening, don't pull out your PowerPoint slide deck and start to give them a science lecture or start to critique their car or their house. Don't judge them and try and understand where they're coming from.
Yeah, what are the do's?
Yeah, well, first of all, understand where they're coming from and what they're hearing. Don't bring up messengers that they don't trust. Try and find messages they do trust. Frame it in a way that resonates with your audience. When I speak to business audiences, I don't talk about radiative forcing or carbon loading. I talk about consumer demand, operational mm-hmm. efficiency, cost of capital. Put it in a language that people can understand. And some of the frames that are being examined within the social science literature are frames around national security. There is a group of Army generals, the CNA group, that said that climate change is a threat multiplier, that it will destabilize regions of the world, and the U.S. military will have to go in and deal with this. Thomas Friedman has been pushing the idea this is an issue of economic competitiveness. If we don't develop the energy technologies of the future, someone else will buy them. Some people push forward the frame of risk management. You have a low probability, high consequence event. And what do we do about that? Well, we actually all have that in our lives when we buy fire insurance for our home. Hmm. The odds of it burning down are low, but I can't take the hit. on climate change. What is that form of insurance? Well, it's investment in technology development, trying to develop behavior change around energy efficiency. Another frame is health. You know, the key here is to really make it salient and personal, and health does that because when you have extreme weather events, think about high temperatures in urban centers, who gets hit the first and the hardest? It's the senior citizens, sure, and the young children. And we can all resonate with that because we have perhaps grandparents or parents or children, and we don't want them to be harmed. And so that health frame seems to work quite well.
Lots of ideas, and you can find out more in the book, How Culture Shapes the Climate Change Debate, by Andrew Hoffman, who, of course, is the professor of sustainable enterprise and director of the Erb Institute for Global Sustainable Enterprise at the University of Michigan. Always a pleasure to talk with you, Andy. Thank you so much.
Same here, Cynthia. Thank you very much.